Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this second hour of the program, we'll be talking with a French journalist and philosopher, Bernard-Henri Lévy. He is one of the leading writers in France and certainly is well known there. We'll talk this morning, though, about a new book that is about what it means to be an American. And the title of the book is American Vertigo, Traveling America in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. It's published by Random House and is out just recently. You can certainly find it in the bookstore. It's a book that had its beginning in the suggestion by the Atlantic magazine, for which he has written, that he spent some time traveling around America and, in a sense, to reprise the journey taken back in the 1800s by Alexis de Tocqueville. Lévy himself says that in doing this, he hoped to get a better understanding of a number of things, including of anti-Americanism, that is, of European anti-Americanism, of what Europe and America can learn from each other, and also about the future of American democracy. And you can sample the book and see how well he has succeeded in coming up with answers to those questions, and sample this morning also some of his ideas, and call in and ask questions. On the show here, as always, questions and comments from people who are listening are invited. We ask only that people try to be brief just so we can keep things moving along and get in as many callers as possible. However, callers are certainly invited. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our guest has written a number of books, including, just to mention a couple of titles, Barbarism with a Human Face and Who Killed Daniel Pearl. His writing has also appeared in a wide range of publications throughout Europe and the United States. And he is talking with us this morning by telephone. Mr. Lévy, hello.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Glad to be with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. And as I explain, it's my understanding that this really began with an invitation or a suggestion by the people at Atlantic that you do some articles, and then the book is, in a sense, an elaboration upon those things that you wrote for Atlantic.
Yes, absolutely. I would certainly not have had alone such an idea, you know, to make this long journey in America, to spend 1 year of my life in this huge and immense and great country, and to do that in the footsteps of such a great writer of as Alexis de Tocqueville. I would certainly not have had the idea alone without the strong suggestion, strong invitation from a venerable and great American magazine, which is The Atlantic.
I was interested to learn, as you explain in the book, that apparently as much as de Tocqueville is still well thought of here in the United States, and there are people who have read and perhaps still read what he wrote about the United States, that in France he's not particularly held in very high regard.
Absolutely. It's often the problem, you know, in your own country, you are, as we say in French, you might be much more famous abroad than in your own place. It is the case for Tocqueville. Tocqueville was for a long time considered in his country as a second-rank author. Maybe because of the influence of Marxism in France, maybe because of the influence of the so-called structuralist thinkers, maybe because of the radicalism, which was since during such a long time à la mode, up to date in France. this liberal thinker, liberal in the French meaning, which means conservative, conservative thinkers, Democrat and conservative, who is Alexis Tocqueville, was quite out of the mainstream. And in America, it's the contrary. In America, I know, and I checked that so many times, that his name is known, well known. His writings are taught in schools, in high schools, and so on. And he belongs to the landscape, to the intellectual, ideological landscape of any enlightened young American of today. Mm.
And I guess it is my understanding that he was interested in not only trying to gain a better understanding of the United States, but in the process, perhaps to better understand his own country and what was happening in France at that time.
Of course. Alexis de Tocqueville considered the democracy in America as really exemplary. An example, a modern, a new pattern of regime, a new sort of society, which was taking birth really in America and which was about to spread and to extend all over the world. So America was, for Tocqueville, the laboratory. Mm-hmm. A laboratory of something which was just happening and which he called democracy. So, of course, he was interested in you, but also in us, in America, but also in the whole world, including France. This is true. He had two agendas in his mind when he undertook this journey, one American agenda and a French agenda.
Something that I think is true of the United States, and you certainly seem to have picked up on it and remark upon, is this, that for all of our bluster, for all of our talk about American exceptionalism, for all of the sense that we have that America is the greatest nation, and certainly it is one of the most powerful nations, militarily speaking, and in spite of all of that, there seem to be many Americans who have a vague sense that something is wrong. Now, and depending upon who you ask, they will give you a different answer. Liberals would tell you one thing. Conservatives will tell you something else. So they may disagree on what the problem is. But one thing it seems that they do agree on is that there is a problem. This, as I say, this vague sort of unease that something just isn't quite right.
This is the reason why this is a sign of the fact that you are a great democracy. A great democracy is a regime which doubts of itself. A great democracy is a regime who does not brag about its excellence. On one side, you believe in American exceptionalism, you believe that you have a special mission, you believe that you have a manifest destiny, and on the other hand, you never believe to be quite at the height, at the level of your destiny. You doubt. You have a sort of slight uncertainty, which is the very sign, the living proof, the proper definition of what democracy is. Always tyrannic regimes are sure of themselves. Only authoritarian regimes believe that they do everything at the perfection, perfectly, nothing to add, nothing to correct. This doubt, this fragility of all the certainness is the proof of a real democracy. Yes, of course. And this is one of the things which I really like in America, in spite of everything, in spite of so many aspects of American life with which I feel personally not easy, not comfortable. In spite of that, you have always what you are saying, this feeling that something is wrong, and this feeling that something is wrong is really the mark of real democracy.
Hmm. It is something that seems to be almost an obsession with us, at least that is this constant questioning of talking about, writing about ourselves, who we are, where we are going, where we have come from. And I'm not sure how many other nations do this quite to the extent that we do, and perhaps there are others who do. I think, for example, the Japanese are rather like this as well.
I would not even say Japanese. No, I think you are unique in this sense, unique in this way of questioning yourself. Who are we? Where do we go? What can we hope? Are we at the level of our mission and our destiny? I don't know one nation in the world which inquires with such an anxiety about itself. And by the way, this is an observation I do in one of my chapters at the end of the book. I was so surprised during this journey. This journey took me nearly 1 year. So I traveled all over America during 9 or 10 months, crossing every single state of the country, going in every big town and little city and so on. One thing which impressed me was in the Barnes & Noble, in the Borders, in the bookshop, the number of books exactly on that. Mm-hmm. The number of books where America interrogates herself about herself. I don't know one other country where you could have this phenomenon. Generally, countries are completely, plainly, fully content of, proud of, glad of themselves. You know, this self-contentment, which is sometimes very stupid, and which you don't find so much. You find it sometimes, of course, in America, but not so much, and it is not the rule. The rule is the contrary, the questioning of yourself.
Let me just ask one other question, and then I have a caller here, so we will get to them. Certainly, the relationship, there has been a long and close relationship between France and the United States, although it's also one that has certainly had its ups and downs. And recently there has been tension in that relationship because of the United States and its involvement in Iraq. I think given that, given particularly recent tensions, there might be some people who would be surprised to hear someone who was French talk about the United States with such admiration. I would imagine that many of your countrymen would strenuously disagree with you about the United States.
Believe me, I am not the Frenchman who loves America. I am not the Frenchman. No, no, no. There are a few others and many others, and America has a big deal of sympathy in my country. The reverse is true also. I was so constantly warned against American Francophobia. I was said that I would be received badly because being French, that I looked for that. I seeked Francophobia, and frankly, I can tell you, I met hundreds and hundreds of persons during this journey. I did not meet a single one who looked down at me in a dismissive way because I was French. I would tell you, I did not. Contrary, the hospitality, warminess, oh, you are French, that's fine, tell me about Paris and so on. This was the reaction of curiosity, reaction of sympathy, and feeling that we share the same values. This was said to me everywhere, from Seattle to Newport, and from Detroit to Miami, or to San Diego. It was said so many times to me, we share the same values. We are more than allies. We have the same vision of the world and the same philosophy, rooted and linked to very important events. You know, there is a part of the book also where I say that. Two things. Number one, as for myself, I have been grown up in a family where one of the first messages I received from my father and my mother, my father who was a freedom fighter against the Nazis during the Second World War, one of the first things which were taught to me was that if I existed, if I lived, if I had been born, it was because of the American army. It was because of you who contributed to the liberation of France against the German and the Nazis. I would not have been born. This, for me, is a primary, deep conviction. I was taught that when I was 4 or 5 years old. I am a Jew. My father was a fighter. He would have been killed at last without the D-Day, the Normandy, Omaha Beach, and so on, all these beaches in France who have still some American names. We have a lot of beaches in Normandy, you know that, which are named after American names till today. And in spite of the quarrels of little boys in a sandbox, which our presidents nourish and so on, we have beaches with American names. In the other side, in the American side, I discovered with a great surprise that at the end of the day, everybody here knows that a long time ago, when America was a colony, when America belonged to an empire, which was the British Empire, America became America by a process of liberation from the British Empire. At this time, who was the ally? Who helped America in its war of decolonization, in its freedom war? France. France was at your side. So these two facts, us being with you in your liberation war, you being with us in our survival war, makes a link, a link of cement, of concrete, which nothing can break, and to which I wanted to contribute by writing this American Vertigo and by publishing it in America before France, as a sort of homage to the American audience and to the American reality. I wanted to contribute to this strong, ancient, impossible to destroy link.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bernard-Henri Lévy. He is one of France's leading writers. He is philosopher, journalist, activist. He writes for The Atlantic Monthly, and his 30 books include most recently Who Killed Daniel Pearl, which was an international bestseller, and the book we are talking about here this morning. It's titled American Vertigo, Traveling America in the Footsteps of Tocqueville, and it's published by Random House. We do have a caller. I expect to hear as time goes along. We'll get some others. We will talk first with our first person here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to first say that I'm an admirer of the your guest and his work and his country, and also that my father served in France during World War II. He was stationed, I think, for the most part, in Metz, and had just wonderful things to say about France. So I grew up hearing terrific things about France when I was a young child. But actually, I'm calling maybe so you guys can hear an example of American passion, because I almost got into an accident driving to the to home to call up about the previous guest, who was a doctor who said that a mother who was calling in worried about her child, who she thought might be daydreaming too much. I think he terrified that mother by saying that perhaps her child had epilepsy. I can't tell you how upset that is to me. I remember a few years ago there was another doctor on your show who, when a woman called in saying she was having problems breastfeeding, was told by that doctor that maybe she should get a preemptive mastectomy. There's an over-medicalization of small, ordinary problems that is in this culture, and I hope and pray that the woman who called in last hour, who is terrified by that doctor, who said, you know, maybe her son should get a CAT scan because her son is daydreaming too much, can hear at least one person who is utterly appalled by what that doctor said, and that she should know that, no, in fact, her son has a deep, rich inner life, that it's absolutely and utterly normal to daydream, and she should not terrify her child by getting him a CAT scan because he spends too much time looking in the mirror and thinking. So I'm sorry to break into this current show, but I was just so appalled that I had to say something, and I'll just get off now. Thanks for hearing me out. Bye.
All right. Well, I don't know that particularly applies to the conversation we're having here with the guest.
In a way, because this is one of the questions which I raise in American Vertigo. Of course, the relationship of this nation of America with medicine, with medical power. I raise this question, for example, when I arrive in Dorchester, in the Mayo Clinic, this clinic where Ernest Hemingway was taken care of, and according to some, were put further in his depression and so on. So, of course, there is a real problem with medical power in America, which has two forms. For me, there are two concerns, which seem contradictory, but which might not be so contradictory. Number one, I think that there can be an excess of medical power, an excess of medicalization, an excess of normalization of ordinary life under the power of doctors. This is true. This is a tendency of all Western countries, including America. We have to take care of that. The doctors are not shamans. They are not masters of sex, you know, and we cannot leave the science taking the power on our bodies. We cannot leave our bodies to become the field of experience of the medical science, on one side. On the other side, I'm sorry to tell this so frankly and so candidly, and I'm sorry if I shock some of your listeners, but I believe that you have in this country a problem of healthcare and a problem of involvement of the public authorities, of the administration in the minimal cares which any citizen deserves. I say that not by an ideological point. I don't care about ideologies. But only because I saw during my journey so many poor people, so many depressed areas where you definitely have in this great country, prosperous country, which is America, some people who have not the means to offer themselves, not the medical power, but just the minimal health care, that this is unworthy of this great and model democracy, which is America. So on the left side, if I dare say, you have this problem of excessive medicalization, medical power on the bodies, which has to be reduced. On the right side, on the other side, you have this lack of public accountability on the question of the minimal rights of any citizens to be cured when he falls in a big illness. This is a twofold question which I believe will be in the center of the debates in the next years in this country. Mm. It's my bet. It's my feeling.
Well, I expect that there would be a lot of people listening to you here this morning that would agree. Certainly with the second point that access to healthcare is in this country a very serious issue, and that it is linked to the problem we have with poverty, and that also is, and you yourself and your reflections at the end of the book point out that that is one of our problems.
And fortunately, one of the greatness of America is that you have some great philanthropies, you have some churches who substitute themselves to the state, you have the public, the simple people, generosity. By chance you have that. But if you did not have that, if the people of America was egotist, was closed to himself, the poor people would have nothing. And it would be a disaster. I saw that, for example, it was so clear to me, it was crystal clear, after the Katrina hurricane. After the Katrina hurricane, I was in Texas and in New Orleans. And I saw two things. On one hand, the bankruptcy of the authorities, the failure of the power, whose task, at the end of the day, you can say it in the words you want, but the task of a power is to take care of the citizens. Of course, by giving to the citizens a great responsibility, of course, the state cannot substitute itself to the liberty and the freedom of each one. Of course, but at the end of the day, there is a task of taking care of the poorest. On one side, there was a bankruptcy of this principle. On the other side, in Texas, I was so impressed by the very simple American citizens, men and women, who welcomed the refugees, the survivors of Katrina, who welcomed them by opening their houses, by opening their hospitals, by opening their schools, their hearts, their arms, their personal wallet, in a way which seemed to me unprecedented in any developed country. I never saw that anywhere. I did not see that in France. I'm not sure that if this sort of event happened in France, we should see the same. So America is a contradictory place, paradoxical, where on the one hand, you have a state which really does not do the job, does not do the job. And on the other hand, some citizens, which greatness and nobility is to do the job in the place of the state. But this is not completely normal. The state, the political institutional authorities should take their part.
We have another caller to talk with, this one in Springfield on our toll-free line. So let's do that. We'll go there. Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a very good show, very provocative. I'm on a cell phone, and so I'll make a couple of quick comments and a question and go ahead and ring off.
Okay.
Actually, your guest kind of stole a little bit of my thunder from what I was going to ask, but that's okay. I'll go ahead. Was wondering, with your guest, with his extensive travels, so much is made out of separate Americas. I mean, my observation is we have a country, but we have so many separate rails running on the same track. And what I was trying to ask is if he observed that, and for instance, you mentioned Katrina, the blacks in this country make up about 12%, and yet if you were to put on the sports or entertainment, I would think you would think they'd be a much larger percentage of the population. And also with the recent funeral of Coretta Scott King, where the opportunity was taken, whether or not you like the president, I don't know, but basically to lambaste him for Katrina. And, I mean, it's almost like you can't win for losing. And I understand that's a democracy, but George Will, not too long ago, said it's almost like segregation by choice, where you have a certain population and they're not buying into the big picture. Whether or not they think they're part of it or not, I don't know, but it just seems that we have a lot of separate Americas, and I'd be interested in the comments of your guest. Thank you.
I appreciate the question. I know this is something that he has thought about and writes about in the book.
Yes. A big part of the book is devoted to that. If I understand well your point, but you were a little far and the cell phone cut sometimes, so I hope I got your point. Of course, the question of racism, the question of civil rights, the question of equality between races is not completely solved in America. It's clear. And the real solution, which would be a real mixity of the bodies, mixity of the souls, mixity in the churches, is not achieved. This is clear. When you go in Willow Creek, the big mega church near Chicago, you hardly see an African American. And when you go in Memphis, in the big mega churches of Memphis, you hardly see a white man. So this is true that you have still a real a cohabitation of two worlds. But what I can tell you, after having traveled especially in the states of the South, Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas, and so on, that America has achieved a process, has made a progress since 30 or 40 years, which is, again, absolutely unprecedented in any country. I say in the book there is a chapter which is called Slavery by Another Name. I mean by that 40 years ago in America, you had still slavery by another name. I depict the process. I say exactly in what form. The fact is there. After the Second World War, nearly one century after the Civil War, you had still some slavery in America. 40 years after. 40 years after the dream of Martin Luther King. 40 years after the great civil rights movement. This is over. Racism in America, I would not say that you have not still some persons who are racist, but racism is forbidden. It's censored. It cannot be expressed. It is on the defensive. When you meet, it was so striking for me in Alabama. I knew that some of my interlocutors had such feelings, but they did not dare to say. They did not dare to express. This means that the fight of Martin Luther King has won, and has won at least more than half the process. And coming from so far and having done so much, this is frankly at the honor, at the credit of the American democracy. So it's not over, of course, but it is on the process.
One of the great, I suppose some people might say, one of the great national myths we have is that when the country was formed, different people came together from different places, different backgrounds, maybe in some sense different priorities, but that they came together and were drawn together by a common set of beliefs that then became the core beliefs of America. And this goes to the old motto, the "E pluribus unum" motto, out of many one. I think that people worry today, though, and this may in part also be what the caller was thinking about, that has begun to break down, and that there are too many different people, different groups of people. So it could be people divided by their politics, by their ethnicity, by their religion, by their the part of the country where they live in, that indeed that America is becoming fragmented, and that as a result, we are losing that core set of beliefs that we all share, and with those things that somehow made America what it is. That is also something that you write about, you seem to say, yes, in part that's true, but that perhaps it's not as bad as we sometimes think.
Exactly. This problem is, I try to deal with that in the last chapter, the chapter called Reflections of the book. It's a big part of the book, and my conclusion is not so pessimistic. I believe, of course, that there is a risk. There is a risk of Balkanization of the social and political space of America. But I would say, number one, that you always had this problem. In the 20s, in the 30s, you had some German minorities in some states like Wisconsin or others, which were much more apart from the nation than the Hispanics of today, for example. So you had this problem and you did overcome it. American democracy had already the strength to overcome it, first. Number two, what impresses me is the way in which the peculiarity and the American patriotism combine and articulate themselves. One example, Dearborn. Near Detroit, Dearborn, which is an Arab city, a city with a minority of Arabs, and which is truly patriotic and American. I was so surprised when I met the people of Dearborn, who are really Muslim, faithful to Islam, Arabs with some butcheries, some meat, you know, or some McDonald's where you have a billboard indicating that the meat is halal, but when you speak with them, they are truly, completely, perfectly, from toes to toes, top to toes, American. When they say we think that, we believe, blah, 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 it is not we Arabs, which they mean, but we Americans. And when I ask them, this is on my book, I call this the Jewish dream of American Arabs. When I ask them, what is their dream? What is their aim? What is their future? They tell me the answer is, our aim is to succeed as the Jews succeed in America. Comparing that to my country, where the Arabs in France really hate Jews, it makes a real difference. And another example, a man like Barack Obama. There is a portrait in the book, a profile, a long meeting and portrait of Barack Obama, who is one of the most impressive people I met during this country. Barack Obama, he's a Democrat. He stands against the Republicans and so on. But remember the sentence in his speech at the Democratic Convention. There is not a black and a white America. There is not a left and a right America. There is not a blue and a red America. There is only the United States of America. This is the belief of Barack Obama, who has his ideas, his opinions, who fights strong against his adversaries, but he believes that at the end of the day, there is one America. And this old belief, which made the country alive, which made it made its birth and made it alive, is still alive today. This is my deep conclusion in this part of the book.
Let me introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580, Bernard Henri Lévy. He's philosopher, journalist, activist, filmmaker. He has authored a number of books, including Barbarism with a Human Face and Who Killed Daniel Pearl. His writing has appeared in a wide range of publications throughout Europe and the United States, including the Atlantic Monthly, and is the author of this new book that explores the territory we're talking about here this morning. And that book is entitled American Vertigo, Traveling America in the Footsteps of Tocqueville. It's published by Random House. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to call, toll-free 800-222-9455. When Tocqueville came here to the United States, one of his reasons, sort of one of his stated reasons, was to look at prisons in the United States. And so you decided that you would do the same and spent some time touring some American prisons. One of the first places I think you went when you came to the United States to start this project was Rikers Island in New York. And you were in some other places. You were in Guantanamo.
Yes.
What sort of thoughts did you come away with after having that experience?
I think it is not the best part of America, the prisons. It is not the best part. Maybe not because of the material conditions of detention. I believe that they are not worse in America than in France, and the prisons are always something very ugly, and they never are paradise. But in American prisons, if I had to go thoroughly in it, I would say that there is two things which makes a difference. First thing is the death penalty. Even if in jails when you have only short-term penalty, where death penalty is not implied, death penalty is like a big shadow, a big dark cloud, which is above the whole system. You have the shadow of death penalty in all the penitentiary system of America. And this makes a difference with a country like France, which did abolish it, as you know, 25 years ago. And I visited some death corridors, some death rows. I met some people who wait for the death since years and years. I spoke to many American citizens, by the way, who are against or in favor of death penalty, but we seemed to me, and this is a very important point, I want to stress it today, they seemed to me open to the debate. This might be the change, the new thing since maybe 10 years or 15 years. 10 years ago, people in America seemed to me to be much more standing on their point, much more sure of themselves. Today, there is a possibility of opening a debate. I met, for example, I am personally, I say it frankly, I am in favor of abolition of death penalty. But I can tell you that I met, for example, in Illinois, so many Christians who really ask themselves, I don't say that they decide, I don't say that they have the reply, but ask themselves if it is really a normal thing for a man or for a state to withdraw the life from another man, being admitted that the life belongs only to God, only to the Lord. Is it theologically correct for an institution to take the life for a single man? I met other people who are so concerned today about the mistakes of the trials, the possible mistakes, and you have number of them. So this makes a difference, the death penalty. And I believe, I take my risk, I take the bet, I believe that this question will come at the center of the debate much more than it was in the last years. And number two, there is something else in the American prisons which surprised me, is the big number of people whom I am not completely sure I would find in the penitentiary or in a jail in my country. Very little delinquents, very petty drug dealers who are not big criminals and who might become, in a way, a harder criminal after the jail than before. I saw that. I was with Judge Biddle in Chicago. I went in some place when I had this feeling. I would say a sort of intermix, a mix between the penal question and the social questions in some parts of America. And this creates, again, a difference.
Well, let us talk with some other people who are listening. And we'll go next to someone in Urbana, and that would be line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I am a great fan of Bernard-Henri Lévy's, and I read his work, and I think he has a marvelous intelligence and has addressed some of the world's most serious problems. And I'm particularly fascinated by his struggle to understand good and evil and his understanding of one of the things that he has said that really has struck me as a sort of a Jungian view of the projection of evil onto other people and thinking that you can get rid of that people, you can have a paradise on earth. And in particular, I wanted to ask him because I've looked and looked and haven't been able to find. He refers to Pol Pot as a turning point in his life, and that Pol Pot was a very educated man and had this idea that evil was in the linguistics of the languages. And if he could eradicate that, he could somehow turn the world to good. And this was, of course, ended in the horror in Cambodia that turned Monsieur Lévy against the left, sort of. Anyway, I'd like him to expand a little about this view of language and evil that Pol Pot had, if he would.
Yeah, absolutely. What I mean by that is that Pol Pot and the Cambodian Revolution was in a way the first real radical revolution in history. Till Pol Pot, we could always say revolution did not succeed, it turned out to be a dictatorship, it finished in tyranny because it did not go far enough, because it only changed the means of production, it only modified the structure of the state, but the real roots of the slavery, the real roots of the submission, the Leninist, the Castrist revolution, did not go to fetch and to eradicate them. Then came Pol Pot. Pol Pot read Sigmund Freud, for example, Sigmund Freud, psychoanalysis. And Pol Pot knew that the roots of the submission lie in the very desire of the mankind, in the way in which a man desires a woman, or a woman a man. You have the first link of slavery. You may have, if it is a perverse link, you may have the first link of slavery. Then Pol Pot read Ferdinand de Saussure and all the modern linguists, and he knew that the language has the structure of the power. He knew that in the very way in which a sentence is articulated, in the very way in which you have the verb and the complement and the subject, you have the very pattern of the submission and of the slavery. So what did Pol Pot say? He said, I'm going to be the first true revolutionary in history. So therefore, I'm going to go and fetch the roots of the slavery in the desire and in the language. I'm going to change the alphabet. I'm going to wash the brain of my citizens, of my fellow companions, to wash their brains in order to withdraw the old language and to change the old desire. Then I will build the new man, l'homme nouveau, the new man. And he did that. Pol Pot was the first serious revolutionary in the history. He did that. He really washed the brain. He really interfered in the desire, which means by regulating the marriage, by a lot of things. And the result, you know it, it was a bloodbath. It was the worst nightmare we knew after the Holocaust.
Do you write about this somewhere? Is there somewhere I can read more about this that you have written?
I wrote about that in, yes, of course, I wrote about it in American Vertigo a little, the last book. I wrote about it in La Pureté Dangereuse, Dangerous Purity, which is a book a few years ago. I wrote about it in a book which is translated into English, which is called you will find it on Amazon, Les Aventures de la Liberté, the Adventures of the Liberty, or something like that. a history of the French intellectuals. There is a big chapter on this precise topic. I don't know the title in English.
I really admire that you go to places like Darfur way before anybody else is.
Yes, absolutely.
And I really think you are a great humanitarian.
Oh, thank you. No, you should not. I'm pleased to hear that. But thank you very much.
I love that you say that the only thing worse than being massacred is that no one would see it. You know,
I try.
A very true thing, and people have accused you of adventurism and all this crazy stuff. But I think it's very brave of you even to follow in Daniel Pearl's footsteps. It takes great courage.
It was a big stake for me, a very important moment of my life. You know, it was I had two encounters with America recently. The American vertigo, of course, but I had already Daniel Pearl, who was for me a real American hero, turned into a martyr in a very ugly place. And I did want to retrace his footsteps and to find out what had happened, who killed, and why.
Well, I just thank you so much for talking.
Thank you, madam. Thanks a lot to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. We want to have at least one other caller here in the time that remains, and we have another Urbana person. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I recently attended Garrison Keillor's Pry Home Companion show over in West Lafayette, Indiana. It was wonderful, and it was interesting to see that he pretty much savages your American vertigo in his review in the New York Times book reviews last January. And he says, for example, that it's evidence that travel need not be broadening and one should be wary of books with Tocqueville in the title. I was wondering if you'd ever heard his show, The Prairie Home Companion. It's very popular in the Midwest, and what you thought of it. And then number two, if there's time, I also read an interview you had with the Miami Herald, and you said the story of Elian Gonzalez is very important. Could you talk about that as well? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay.
About Garrison Keillor, of course I know his show. Of course I know it. I know it and I like it. I like his show. I would not say that he savaged my book because he did not speak of my book. He asked me to go home. He asked me to go back to my country. He did not review my book. I would not say that. For example, the very word, the very fact that I went into American jails, that I went in areas of poverty, it does not appear at all in its funny and talented piece. But it is a piece of Garrison Keillor, not a piece about Bernard-Henri Lévy. It's a big fun, but it is not about my book. Somebody who would have only read his piece would not have the slightest idea that I went to Rikers Island, that I went to Guantanamo, that I tried to investigate about all that. My book is about all that. I'm sorry to tell it. It is not only a Frenchman journeying in America and having to go home in the same way as we said in France, Yankee go home. This is absurd. Anti-Americanism on one side, Francophobia on the other. I don't want to play this game. I don't want to enter that. I wrote American Vertigo precisely to avoid that and to escape this sort of stupid game. Discussion.
Yes, I have to tell you, Mr. Levy, that we don't have a whole lot of time, so I can't. I wish we had more time because I think it's an interesting question that the caller poses. I maybe can give you about a minute if you want to talk about Elian Gonzalez.
Elian Gonzalez, yes. I think that the fact that it was given back to Castro was a shame. It was a shame because I think it would not have taken place 20 years ago or 15 years ago when the Cuban, where you had the Cold War, when Soviet Union was the enemy, and when the Cuban community was at the center of the game, I think the American administration would not have put Elian back to his country. The fact that he has been put back means that the Cuban question is less in the center of the topic. It implies a real bitterness in the Cuban community, which I can understand in a way. And I did not like this all this story. I did not like it.
Mm. Well, I'm sorry that we have to finish.
But we must, because
we've come to the end of the time. In any case, we must. And I'm very pleased that you could give us some of your time. And I certainly would suggest to people that after having heard the conversation that they look at the book, which is American Vertigo, and it's published by Random House by our guest Bernard Henri Levy. Also, you might want to look at his book Who Killed Daniel Pearl, which got a lot of attention and rightly so when it came out. Mr. Levy, I want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks to you, and sorry for my pitiful English and for my broken accent.
Believe me, sir, you have no need to apologize.
No, I apologize deeply. I'm ashamed of that. And thanks for your patience and the patience of the listener.
Thank you. Just maybe one quick question. I'm curious. Did you write American Vertigo in English?
No.
So you wrote it in French.
Much better. The book is much better than what I say, because I had a great translator, Charlotte Mandel, who is more than a translator, a partner in a sort, and she did a great job of a translation.
All right. Well, again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.